The Artist Own Pack podcast may contain adult language. Listener discretion is advised.
Yellow.
Hey, Kev, it's Aaron.
Who?
Aaron Roden, the guy doing the all-new Artist Home podcast for you guys.
The what?
We can talk about all that later. Why don't you tell me what's going on with Artist Home right now?
Well, right now I'm just doing the record club. It's just $23 a month. People go to therecordclub.org, and every month they get a brand new vinyl record from an independent artist that we love. And
oh, that sounds awesome, man. What do you guys got up right now? What are you sending to people?
Well, I am currently packaging a Sleater Kinney's Live in Paris. It's our first live album that we're sending.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That sounds awesome. So where can they go again to sign up for this?
Therecordclub.org, and it's $23 a month, and they get a preview at the beginning of the month. And if they want to skip that month, they don't have to pay for it. Easy peasy. Super fun.
Oh, that's awesome, man. Well, thank you so much, Kev.
Okay. What's this podcast thing?
Let's get started with the show. Welcome, everyone, to the all-new Artist Home podcast, where every month we take a glimpse of what drives the creators of the art we love so much here in the Pacific Northwest. I am your host, Aaron Roden, and in this episode, we're going to be talking with Dave Depper, guitarist for the band Death Cab for Cutie, and also recently a solo artist with the release of his first full-length album, Emotional Freedom Technique, out right now on Tender Loving Empire Records. Dave has deep roots in the Pacific Northwest music scene. As a Portland, Oregon resident, he has played with the likes of artists such as Fruit Bats, Menomina, Corin Tucker of Sleater Kinney, and Laura Gibson, to name a few. And in 2014, he was asked to join Ray LaMontagne's touring band, and their first show was on late night television in front of millions and millions of eyes. So we're going to talk about that coming up in a little bit, but let's just jump right into this conversation, shall we, with Dave Depper. And we're going to enter into it talking about his solo album and how it came to be. I think it's an interesting story, and I hope you enjoy it. Let's talk with Dave.
Yeah, here I am.
Well, good deal.
Yeah.
Good deal. You live down in Portland, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So how did this all start for you, man? Like first of all, we do have to say that you have a solo album that is out now. Mm-hmm. Came out on June 9th on Tender Loving Empire Records. It's called Emotional Freedom Technique. This is your first solo album.
My first. There's some asterisks required here, yes, I'm sort of calling it that. My first solo release was something called the Ram Project, which I did 6 years ago, and I re-recorded Paul McCartney's album Ram.
Right. Okay. And I read about that.
Yeah. So, but
and then completely forgot.
Oh well. Yeah. But it's that was like the first Dave Depper release, I guess.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It wasn't my own songs. I mean, I'm super proud of it, and it was a fun, crazy experiment. But
sure.
And then I released an instrumental EP a few months ago of guitar improvisation stuff. But no, this is the first like 9 songs that I wrote and performed recorded. And yeah, so I am considering it like my official solo debut.
Well, it's a fantastic album.
Thank you.
There's a lot of kind of like 1980s nostalgia that's worked into it, which I absolutely
can love. I hit you up for a ride, touching down at 2:45, made up some time along the way. We never talk about anything at all. Can I spot the usual?
It took me a really long time to figure out what the album was going to be about. Like, I just didn't know what kind of songwriter I was. I didn't know what I had to say, and I tried 101 different lyrical approaches to things. Like musically, things came very quickly to me. I'm the king of like overdubbing a super elaborate 3-minute long pop song without any lyrics, and then just forgetting that it exists because I can't think of what I wanted to say on it. But this I had to put my foot down on this, and a lot of the songs existed instrumentally, and had a bunch of different lyrical approaches, and none of which really convinced me. And then kind of out of nowhere, the last song on the album just appeared. And I don't know why still, but it was, I was just thinking about this relationship that had happened like 10 years before, and like time traveled back to that heartbreak I had, and it sort of tumbled out of me. And I, all of a sudden, that was sort of the blueprint for the record, was realizing that this kind of hyper honest emotional confessional thing was sort of what I wanted to pair with this bubbly pop record, oddly. I don't know why. Initially came out of this playing this thing called the 20 song game, where okay. You get together with a few friends and you each independently are challenged to write and record 20 songs in 12 hours.
Yeah, I've heard of this.
And then you get back together and you all listen to each other's songs, and it's mm-hmm. this insane thing. And
is it like You just stated that like you're the kind of guy that like if you can't figure something out with the song, then you just like discard it.
Yes.
Fully.
Yes.
Like it was this kind of a nerve-wracking experience for you doing like the 20 song, especially with like friends. With
absolutely. That's and that's the whole listening to it at the end of the day is what holds you accountable. It's like, well, people are going to listen to this, and I have agreed to finish this. So it's like, it was the exact opposite of what I am comfortable with. So, but that's what started this album, was that I just, that's what, how I at least found the genre I wanted to be in. Cause I mm-hmm. didn't even, at that point I'd toured with so many different bands and played with different people. I was like, am I like a indie folk artist? Do I make instrumental techno music? Like, am I going to start a Pink Floydish band? Like, I just didn't know. And so I sat down and did this, and all these different styles kind of came out of me too. But one of the songs was Never Worked So Hard, and the other was Anytime, Anywhere. And those were two of those 20 songs that happened that day.
Okay.
Like
okay.
embryonic versions, like they, you know, one only had like a chorus and a verse, and one didn't have a bridge, and
sure.
they needed to be finished. Sure. But and at the end of the day, we were all listening back to these songs, and my friends that I was doing it with, both of those songs, they were kind of like, what is this? This is, I've never heard this kind of thing from you. This is super intriguing. And that, I just took that and ran with it. So those two songs sort of formed the musical blueprint. And that started me just recording endless kind of synth pop stuff. But and that's where the lyrical challenge came in, where I was
sure.
just not sure what I wanted to say. And then the last song, Hindsight, on the record is the one I was just referring to that kind of tumbled out. And
this
then,
is the 6 minute, 38 second song at the end of the record, which
yes.
is fantastic. It's almost like, I called it like in my notes, I was like, this is like the opus at the end of the record. I don't know if that's the right term for it, but because it kind of like, I mean, it changes styles throughout the song.
Yeah,
which is
yeah.
great. I love it.
Thank you.
I love that song.
It's yeah. It's I mean the it's the first song part of the song's called Hindsight. This feels so pretentious to be saying, but whatever. I made an album. I can do whatever I want.
Yes, you
can. And then the second half is called Emotional Freedom Technique, and it's the
okay.
title track. And so it's kind of like the joyful release of the record. Like if we are talking about it as a concept album,
sure.
it's like making that record really was a journey of kind of resolving this 3 or 4 year period of super emotional confusion and detachment. And making the record really was the therapy of that. And
so you really felt like after this thing was done that you had kind of released some demons.
Yes, very much so.
Huh.
Yeah, it was a very unexpected result in making this record. It sort of made me realize that I was more fucked up. Can I say fucked up?
Yeah.
On this
yeah,
podcast? Okay.
Totally.
More fucked up during the recording of it than I thought I was. And then that making it was a much more healing experience than I ended up expecting it to be as well. So it is a very, like for me, a very personally powerful thing that happened recording the record. And yeah, that last track really was the expression of release after completing the record. And I did that entire last bit of that song was done in this like crazy 18-hour recording session where I just like stayed up all night long and recorded like 50 layers of guitars and synthesizers, and that's how it ended.
I'm seeming to like, and this may not be true at all because I do very little research.
That's quite all right.
I don't like to do a lot of research. But did you like major in guitar or something like that? Did you do music as study?
I started that. I did 2 years of majoring in guitar at University of Oregon and hated it. Not anyone's fault at University of Oregon. It just being a music major wasn't for me, and it also kind of, I just didn't think it through. I was like, what do I want? Why am I majoring in guitar? Like, do I want to be a guitar teacher? Do I want to, you know, I just thought, oh, I'll major in guitar and then I'll be a guitarist. And right. So I actually halfway through dropped out of the program and switched to computer science, and I graduated with a computer science degree and then moved to Portland and was a software engineer. Like,
you're shitting me.
For real, at age 22, and I got this job. I just lucked into finding this cool startup company. And I was in tech way before it was cool to be in tech, and so I was just doing that, and you know, really playing guitar on the side, not thinking about a musical career in mm-hmm. any sense. And
so wait, let's go back just a second,
mm-hmm.
because and this is something that I've always felt. And I think it's, you know, it's partly because I just couldn't focus on like learning like theory and how to read music and stuff besides tab, mm-hmm. you know. But it was always something that like it kind of killed the creativity bug for me, like learning about. And I'm not saying this happens for everybody, of course, because of course it does not. But like, learning all of that stuff and like kind of drilling down on like theory and how, you know, everything fits together in a mathematical way
mm-hmm.
really kills that creativity thing for me.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. I think at this point in my life, I would probably really enjoy going back to school for that and, uh-huh. and getting into it. But at the time, I wasn't there at all. I'm glad that I learned like the fundamentals of theory and aural sure. skills, and it made me a better keyboardist and that kind of thing. But I just despised the academic nature of breaking it down that way. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. just like being forced to listen to music in a not fun way. Like I just wanted to listen to what I wanted to listen to. I didn't want to like analyze. I don't even know what the hell we were
doing. Did you find yourself doing that though? Like you pop in like you're wearing a King Crimson shirt. So that's
I'm seeing them tonight at the Moore Theater.
Oh, nice. Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome.
But
that's going to be a great show.
I can't wait. I'm so excited.
But like when you're listening, you just pop in, let's say a King Crimson record, and mm-hmm. you're just like, all of a sudden you're like, well, I don't even know. that's a major seventh, fifth on, you know, whatever.
Yeah. I wasn't interested in thinking that way then. And I do much more now think of it that way. And I have thought about going back to school a little mm-hmm. bit, but yeah, I just wasn't interested And so I emerged like with very little desire to be a musician other than I kind of did it on the side. And I moved to Portland and like was quite happy riding my bike to the office every day and writing computer code and coming home.
Uh-huh.
And after about a year of that, I got the itch to just play a little more, but more so I needed a keyboard. I was like, I had a guitar and I was like, I would love to have a keyboard sitting around to plink around on. And so I looked on Craigslist and there was a guy selling a Farfisa organ and I met up with him. And this was one of those moments that absolutely changes your life. Like I met this guy, his name was Chad Crouch and he ran a record label called Hush Records. And that label is very well known for launching the Decemberists.
Yeah.
And this other band called Norfolk and Western that was kind of going for it at the time. Anyway, we met up and hit it off and I bought the organ from him and he mentioned that his band needed a bass player and asked if I played bass. And it, like, I just said yes for no, I don't know why. I didn't play bass. I didn't own a bass. I had touched one like three times in my life. Mm-hmm. But I said yes. And he said, well, why don't you come by next week? We're rehearsing. So I came by. And I bought a bass on Craigslist, like on the way to his house. I even called him up and was like, hey, man, do you have a bass amp? Mine's in the shop. And he was like, yeah, even though I did not have a bass amp. I got the gig. I started playing shows around Portland. I met all sorts of people. And then we went and recorded a record at the studio called Type Foundry, which was run by the Norfolk and Western guys. They asked if I'd join their band. I did. Rachel, the drummer of that band, was drumming for the Decemberists at the time. And then she got a gig playing drums for Jolie Holland, and they needed a bass player.
It sounds like you're going down a list.
Yes,
of like all these different things that happen. It sounds like you've had this conversation before.
Well, I have. I mean, I've given a lot of interviews lately, I guess, yeah, but yeah. not in this detail. But I've been able to keep track of it very specifically in my head because it was such a specific series of events that led to other specific events.
Well, it's so weird too, because like on your when you were on your way over here, like I was thinking about this in this realm. I was like, how do you, what the fuck happens here? Because like because you go from you know being a guy that does code,
mm-hmm.
to all of a sudden, well, not all of a sudden, but a few years down the road, you're playing fucking arenas,
yeah,
with bands like or people like Ray LaMontagne and Death Cab for Cutie. Like it just like, what's the interview process like getting into a band like Death Cab? You know, I mean, it's just so
lie
it's just so
as
strange.
Much as possible.
That's great. I'm writing that down. Was there any anxiety, like? As you go from step to step, mm-hmm. right? Like, I mean, there's got to be a little bit of maybe not anxiety, but like excitement around like, you know, creating, you know, these relationships and career moves.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there were kind of like two halves to my career, I guess. The first half was the one I was starting to describe and it just very organically kind of kept growing, and sort of at the apex of that, I was playing with Menomina and the Fruit Bats and Corin, kind of all in this same 2-year period and doing a lot of session work around Portland and stuff. And it kind of all just stopped around the same time.
Stopped? Like
the Fruit Bats broke up, Menomina more or less broke up, right. And it's not like...
And then Corin went back with Sleater-Kinney.
And all of a sudden, I kind of, after years and years of I not only knowing what the next gig was, but the next three, you know, lined up in my planner, it was like I just had all this time. And like weirdly, right around then, I got contacted by the same old computer job I'd had asking if I wanted to come back like half time. And I was like, yeah,
you,
okay.
You lucky son of a bitch.
It was great. I was like, well, yeah, okay. And I was really very resigned, happily resigned. Like, yeah, I did the music thing. It was great. You know, if it happens again, cool. But I'm back to this nice life, riding my bike to work. And there were things about normal life that I missed a lot. Like my relationships had really suffered. This gets into like how this Emotional Freedom Technique album kind of came to be. But I'd been touring kind of so much that I was really sort of out of touch with normal relationships and day-to-day routine and that kind of thing. And so I was like doubly committed to kind of living this normal life and having like a girlfriend and,
yeah,
and doing all this stuff. And I was like about 6 months into this and feeling good when out of the blue, I got a call from Ray LaMontagne's people. It was like the most shocking thing of my life, basically asking like, we need you for the next year. Can you be in LA to rehearse in 3 weeks? Your first gig is on David Letterman. Can you do it?
Really?
We need to know right away. Yeah, and it was super, super odd. And the way that had come about, if you're curious about the inside baseball here, basically,
I am.
My friend Richard Swift had drummed on Ray's record. Do you know Richard Swift's music?
That name sounds familiar, but I can't tell if that's like a athlete also has the name of like Swift.
He's very
or
fast.
He's very fast.
He's kind of this like Oregon wonderkind guy. Now okay. He plays in the Black Keys. Now he was okay. In the second to most recent incarnation of the Shins. He's produced all sorts of amazing records. He's amazing. He's
awesome.
He's really something. And I met him through the Fruit Bats back in the day, and he somehow was drumming on Ray's last, the record that I was promoting, Supernova. He'd been drumming on that record, and Ray, it came to the point where Ray was putting together a live band for that, and they were kind of throwing names out, and Richard Swift mentioned my name because they needed like a guy that could play keyboards and sing and play lead guitar. And Richard mentioned my name, and then like Ray's manager, I think, said, hey, is that guy, is Dave Depper the guy that covered Paul McCartney's Ram all by himself? This thing that I had done, like, randomly, was this thing his manager had, like, found in a shop, and he was, like, a big McCartney fan and bought this thing.
Yeah.
And Richard Swift was like, yeah, that's the guy. And he was like, just call him up. Don't even audition him. And so I got this crazy call based on this Paul McCartney album I'd made. Yeah. And you know, and with all of the touring I had done, I'd never been in a bus. I'd never played on TV. I'd never done any of that stuff.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I was just kind of like, yeah, it just didn't happen for me. That's fine. You know, I had a lot of fun. And all of a sudden it was like, I was being offered the sun, the moon and the stars. Like, do I want to be like the lead guitarist for internationally beloved folk guy, Ray LaMontagne?
Well, and also be basically traveling the world, because this is a year-long tour. I imagine that it included a European tour.
Amazingly, no.
It
was
really?
Like only U.S. and Canada.
Holy shit, that must have been a ton of driving then.
It was a lot, and it was like cities that I've never even thought of playing, like Macon and Chattanooga. And
yeah.
It was cool. It was super cool. Yeah, but so like I was all of a sudden plunged into this sort of situation I'd never been in before, like flew to L.A., rehearsed with the band without Ray for 2 weeks, you know, just us. And, you know, I was like being put up in a hotel and then literally flew to New York, met Ray, learned the one song we were playing on Letterman the next day, and then played on David Letterman as like my debut with that band.
Yeah. Yeah.
My debut on TV, like the show, you know?
Sure. Yeah. And now I've asked this question of many people that have been sitting in that same chair, that have done the same thing. Played on national TV for the first time. What was going through your head as you're about to walk out on that stage?
Well, funnily enough, something super mundane. I was playing, it was like the one song I played keyboards on, and I was so annoyed. I was like, this is the one song I'm not playing lead guitar on. I'm playing stupid keys. I'm like a dork. And
like you wanted more spotlight at that point.
I know. Yeah, I know. I get a taste of it and I'm like, I want to look cool as possible. No, I mean, I was delighted to be there, but my keyboard rig had like crashed that morning at soundcheck having a tech was a new concept to me. I was like day one of having a tech, and it was 4 a.m. and I got called by my tech because they were like sound checking at 4 a.m. and my thing wouldn't work. And I did. So my introduction to the Ed Sullivan Theater was like running as fast as I could from my hotel across Times Square up into the Ed Sullivan Theater, like half awake, running onto the stage and like seeing everything there, like Letterman's desk and all this stuff.
Yeah.
But with like a panicked tech being like, dude, your shit's not working. You need to figure it out right now. We have 5 minutes. And I was like, what? And I didn't figure it out. And like, basically this program I was using was crashing randomly like every 10 minutes. And so walking out onto the stage, I was like, oh my God, I hope this doesn't happen. That's what I was thinking. And so I was distracted in this very focused way and it ended up being fine. And in fact, Ray messed up the song and we had to do it twice. So on those shows, if you mess up, it's so fascinating. You tape it again after the crowd leaves.
Really?
Yeah. So if you watch that, I don't work for Ray anymore, so, you know, hopefully I don't get in trouble retroactively saying this. I'm sure he's fine with it. But it's funny. So, like, if you watch that performance, we get introduced, the crowd claps, it pans over to us, and then it cuts to the second performance where we're not in front of the crowd, and then it cuts back to, like, nice job! Your drums? You know, the whole Letterman thing.
Wow, that's so crazy. I didn't know that normally happens.
That's what happens. And I haven't experienced that since then, but talking to other people, yeah, if you mess up, you get a second chance after everyone leaves.
No kidding.
Yeah, and they just splice it in.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So is it like besides like the, you know, like worrying about the rig crashing again or the software crashing, like is that a pretty, that's got to be a pretty surreal experience.
Oh,
like
yeah.
Knowing that, you know, there are millions of people that are going to be watching.
Yeah,
this.
Millions of people. Yeah, absolutely crazy. Yeah, like having to think about every expression on my face or what clothes I'm wearing or like playing these parts, like, and like millions of people are going to watch this and this is going to be recorded and like accessed for the rest of time. Like, I don't know how many people are going to care to look that up, you know, but it's like, yeah. This is like an archival thing, you know. It's different than making a record where you have numerous takes and, you know, you get it right. It's like, this is the thing. I mean, I guess we had two takes, but...
Right, right.
Yeah, it was crazy. And then from there, it was just like all these other shows, all this other stuff.
Have you figured out a happy medium where you can keep those relationships up now? Like, has it become easier or is it just normal?
I would say that logistically, the life of the touring musician is very difficult to grow a new relationship in.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the people that I work and play with make it work because they are in these established relationships and then go on the road. And, you know, it's not easy, but, you know, you can make it work because you have an established base of shared experience and emotion and that kind of thing. But, like, starting a new relationship is very difficult, and nurturing it in the way that relationships need to be nurtured is very difficult. And that's kind of what occurred with the record, and the period of time that I'm talking about in the record is,
yeah,
I just was so gone all the time and unable to kind of form these lasting, meaningful relationships. But I was convincing myself that I was and that I could do it. And they just all ended in the same way.
Yeah.
So yeah, but logistically right now, the nice thing about being in a band consistently now and not having to immediately search for the next gig and being out there is, like, we do have kind of an off period right now where we're doing a bit of stuff, where there's some shows and we're about to, you know, we've been working on the beginnings of a new record. But I do have this kind of extended, like, year that I'm more or less at home and I can actually concentrate on making something work with somebody, or just living a fairly normal day-to-day existence, mm-hmm. which is not very mm-hmm. possible with the comings and going of the road.
Yeah.
So I'm initially encouraged right now. And
well, that's good, man.
Yeah, thanks.
I'm happy to hear that. Because, like, I mean, that's one thing that a lot of people don't think about, mm-hmm. you know? And it goes back to what we were talking about earlier in writing your record, Emotional Freedom Technique. Like, you're gone, man.
Yeah.
You're freaking gone. Like, you know, when you started with Ray LaMontagne, like, you were gone for a year.
Yeah, and that went straight into Death Cab. I literally... There were like three legs of that Ray tour, and uh-huh. after the second one, I had 2 weeks off, and instead of flying home, I flew to Seattle and had my first rehearsals with Death Cab for like
a
week, and then I flew back to the Ray tour,
yeah,
did that, played my last show with him, I think it was November 15th, 2014 in New York, flew to Seattle, began rehearsing with Death Cab.
Now, was this still when Chris Walla was still in the band? Were you like the third guitar player at that point or something?
No, we didn't overlap. I mean, the rough chronology was he basically, they were recording the Kintsugi record and mm-hmm. he gave notice in a cool way. I mean, he indicated that he was not going to continue with the band, but he'd finish the record with them and fulfill their live obligations that year.
Yeah.
And he did, but that's when I was contacted that, like, you know, there would be a transition from him to me. Uh-huh. So I was basically waiting around for when that would happen.
Yeah.
So.
And how did that one come about? Like, how?
that's a long story, but the very short version
yeah,
is
yeah.
I had known the band for a long time, and Ben and I had become pretty close for a variety of reasons. We were doing a lot of running together. His now wife, Rachel, is a really good friend of mine.
Fantastic photographer.
She's amazing. Yeah, yeah. She's so talented. Rachel and I have known each other for quite a while, I guess about a decade. Yeah. And she's a Portlander originally. And so we were just great friends. And he was down there a lot while they were kind of courting. And we started running together, and We'd known each other through musical reasons and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And but that said, it was still the number one most surprising thing that has ever happened to me is when he called me up and asked if I wanted to play guitar in Death Cab for Cutie.
So, that's got to be a pretty rad phone call.
It was pretty rad. Actually, it wasn't exactly
even
a phone call.
Even coming from
it
like,
was,
a, it was, like a good friend.
It was a text asking to meet up to talk about something.
Oh, okay.
And then
okay.
we met up. And I was only a month or two into playing with Ray, and I uh-huh. was in L.A. playing, and they were recording the Kintsugi record, and we met up in Koreatown, and he just dropped this thing on me, and I was yeah. like, are you serious? Like, you're joking. There's a camera somewhere. This isn't real. But it was real, and it was kind of like a, you know, this is going to happen. Just hang out. We're still recording.
Yeah, yeah.
With Chris, and we're playing with him, but when he's done, you come on in. So
that's amazing.
Yeah, it was nuts.
That's amazing.
So yeah, so all that is to say, when the Ray LaMontagne tour wrapped up, I immediately flew back up here to Seattle and started rehearsing with them again, and mm-hmm. then like 2 months later, we started playing shows, and then I headed out on tour. So I was kind of gone for three straight years, basically, up
yeah.
until last fall, really, till about September. And so I've been civilian in it since then, and it's been rad.
Do you like being, I mean, do you, is there a point at which, I've talked to a lot of people about this too, is like, is there a point where you all of a sudden are like, I need to be back out on the road? Like, have you felt that yet?
A little bit. Yeah. I'm definitely like a road dog, I suppose. Mm-hmm. I really enjoy it. It's addicting, you know, it's getting it up in front of 3 to 20,000 people at a time and playing music that I love.
Yeah.
Is an amazing feeling. That said, by the end of the big tour, I was definitely ready to just take a break. It was kind of like sensory overload every single day. And I'm sure, you know, anyone that kind of does this would agree. I'm already like getting little tastes of it this year, because we have like 12 shows this year, and they're kind of like just festivals that we fly out to and play.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of like, oh, I just want a little more. Like, give me like 3 more shows kind of thing, you know.
It's a good thing you're not a heroin addict.
Yeah. It's very addictive. It's so fun, though. I mean, it's just the joy of my life playing music that I came up loving. You know, I loved Death Cab for Cutie so much. And then I love them as people. And then getting to play that music is such a treat. And the relationship that band has with its audience is super special. Just seeing the looks on people's faces, singing along with every song, it is really like kind of a communal, sacred thing when these shows happen. So I can't wait till the next, you know, the next big album cycle. It's going to be a while, but it'll be great when it happens.
Do you think you're gonna still like focus on during these downtimes, like still focus on writing your own material?
Yeah,
as well?
Yeah.
Has this become a love for you as well?
Yes. There's no going back. Yeah. It's great. It feels like a real gift to kind of discover this side of myself, even if I'm 36 when it's happening. But
yeah, yeah.
I've already started working on the next record in earnest, and I think it'll be a really fun thing to be doing when the big band isn't doing something, just kind of fill the time with my own little solo venture.
Well, sure. And it'll keep you away from heroin.
And it will keep me away from heroin. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Man. And I got to say, I mean, one of my favorite tracks on here is Never Worked So Hard, because it sounds very reminiscent of like the chorus of that song is very Phil Collins.
Yes, thank you.
And I love fucking Phil Collins. I love it.
Oh, man. I didn't pick up on that at all when
you
I was
didn't?
Recording it. No.
Really?
And it's only retroactively, literally everyone says that it sounds like Phil
oh,
Collins.
Really?
To the point where now I'm like, yeah, I made kind of a Phil Collins song. Somehow my voice sounded like Phil Collins.
Phil Collins.
Like, I don't know what.
Sounds like Phil Collins. I absolutely love it.
Oh, thank
you. I absolutely love it. I think it's great. So, yeah, great job.
Cool. Thank you.
Bravo, sir. I can't wait to hear the next thing that comes up for you. And congratulations with all your success, too. Being a musician is not the easiest thing in the world, but you've made it work.
Thank you. It's been a lot of dumb luck. I'll tell you that.
Anything else you want to say?
It's a super pleasure to be on your show.
That was what I was hoping you'd say.
Yeah, it's great. I don't know if we were being recorded when we were talking about this, but I've done like a lot of interviews for the first time ever, you know, this record.
Yeah, and the media blitz.
Yeah, but this is the first one where, you know, just sitting around drinking a vodka and LaCroix, just having a convo. It's nice. Yeah. So I appreciate it.
I'm glad you enjoyed it, man.
Yeah. Thank you
very much.
You got it.
Well, that's a pretty good first episode, I think, right? Dave Depper, everybody. Wonderful conversation with that man. And if you are out and about, please go to out and about on the internet, that is. Please go to DaveDepper.com. Get yourself a copy of this album, Emotional Freedom Technique, which is available right now. You can get it on vinyl, CD, or digital. Go to the website and check it out. And let's see. Dave is currently has no shows coming up, but I'm sure that Death Cab for Cutie does. So you can go and check that out as well. See him live on tour. If you'd like to find out more about the podcast or about what Artist Home has going on, Timber Music Festival is coming up in Leavenworth, Washington. And go to artisthome.org for blog posts, news on the events calendar, and everything like that. Artisthome.org. And please check out our other podcasts. Let's see. We've got a couple more episodes that are up and available right now, or they should be. And the best way that you guys can support us is by spreading the word, all right, about this here show. So go and do that as well. All right, we're going to go out today with one of my favorite songs off the album. And this one is called, oh gosh, Never Worked So Hard. We talked about it a little bit there during our chat, and it's definitely one of the standout tracks on this album, and I hope you guys enjoy it. So thank you so much for listening. This is Never Worked So Hard by Dave Depper, and we'll be back next time on the Artist Home Podcast. Thanks for listening.